Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
Yes, now it is time for the weekly chat with Andrew Little. This week, as I said earlier in the show, the Health GCSB and SIS Minister Andrew Little spoke with Justin about counter-terrorism legislation changes after the Lynn Mall terror attack and support for mental health under Auckland's lockdown. But Justin began by asking Andrew Little about the COVID-19 case at Middlemore Hospital.
I want to start by talking about Middlemore Hospital first. Since yesterday, have you heard back the testing results from close contacts inside the ward or from medical staff?
As I understand it, the patients who were exposed have had their first test back, and that has proved negative. I'm not sure what the status of the tests are with the staff who have been stripped down to isolate. I just don't have those test results at the moment.
Okay, but the positive case itself was not isolated from overnight. Even he got a test result and developed a fever. Well, the Ministry of Health said there were no space on isolation wards. So does that mean Middlemore Hospital is running out of isolation spaces?
Well, no, I'm a bit curious about that statement that came forward about that, because I know that also later that afternoon, isolation spaces were found for all of the patients who were in that four-bedroom room with the patient who was tested positive for COVID. The advice I've had is that the person turned up to hospital, he was screened for COVID, there were no indications of COVID, and the information that he gave did not suggest that he was at risk of having contracted COVID. So he wasn't treated as a COVID-positive patient. He was admitted, and then while he was on the ward, he developed a fever. That prompted one of the doctors to have him swabbed and tested for COVID. And he then returned a positive test. And he was in that room with three others during that time. I understand that a deliberate decision was made in terms of the location, the nature of the ventilation and the airflow in that area. He was seen as low risk. Once he returned a positive test, then he was an isolation space was found for him and the other three in the room.
Could he have been moved sooner?
Well, the advice I've had is that they made a judgment call about once he was under suspicion of COVID and had the swab but hadn't had the result back, advice was taken about how they should manage him, and because of the nature of the room he was in and the ventilation and airflow and the space between the different patients, a judgment was made that the risk of infection of others was very low and they should leave him where he was rather than move him to an isolation room. There is a question about whether an isolation room was available at that time. That was Sunday morning. It is clear that isolation rooms did become available in the afternoon because all four patients were sent to one, but it wasn't clear at the time that one was available on the Sunday morning.
Considering the positive case first went into Middlemore Hospital without asymptomatic, is it practical to make all incoming patients to get tested for COVID first?
Well, the reason why they have a screening process, so patients who are coming in are asked a number of questions to evaluate whether or not, or at least what the risk is of them possibly being COVID positive. It's not expected that every patient would be COVID positive, nor for that matter every visitor to the hospital. And so there is some attempt to sort of manage that. Rather than test everybody and assume that everybody is COVID positive until they prove otherwise, because getting a test back can take some hours and it would potentially slow down treatment for people. So the protocols that Middlemore follows, and in fact every hospital follows, are those that have been developed by the public health units on the basis of thorough medical consideration and advice, and they're pretty standard protocols for around the world. So I'm satisfied that the right protocols are in place. It does require the clinicians at the time to make the right judgment, and they do the best that they can to do that.
Okay, moving on. Almost 30 staff from Middlemore Hospitals are being stood down for 2 weeks because they are close contacts of the case. So how much is that going to impact the services provided at Middlemore?
Look, it will cause some disruption to the organisation of services. Already, the Auckland hospitals, both Counties Manukau and Auckland, to a lesser extent Waitemata, have put the call out nationally for additional personnel, and other DHBs from other parts of the country have been providing, particularly nursing staff, to help out the Auckland DHBs. Most of them have gone into actually the vaccination work, but some are going into ICU work, and I think others who will come up to Auckland will go into doing other ward duties as well. So assistance has been sought from other hospitals around the country, and I'm sure that will continue.
How many have been moved up to Auckland so far?
I think there are 41 in Auckland so far, have come in the last week to Auckland. There's another group due, I think, by the end of this week, and I expect more will come up next week.
Okay. Moving on from Middlemore to my second topic of the day, it's about the Lynmore terror attack. Now, the terrorist, we know already, is already part of the terror watch list, but would he have, and the government now is planning to pass the counter-terrorism legislation, would the terrorist have spent more time in custody under if the bill has been passed?
I think one of the things that the legislation will do, the main thing of the amending legislation, bearing in mind that we do have a counter-terrorism act in place already, but it's been found to be deficient. The main change that we're looking at introducing is offences for planning and preparation. And a question is, for this particular person, given the events on Friday, is there anything that could have happened, or is there anything that he did that would have constituted a planning and preparation offence that meant that he could have been detained before he carried out the attack? And it's not clear from the information that I've seen so far that is the case, that there was an act on his part that constituted planning or preparation that would have meant the police could have intervened earlier, detained and arrested him and processed him. So there's that part of it. The other is whether we introduce a form of control order. So we changed the legislation a couple of years ago for people returning from overseas who have engaged in supporting terrorist organisations. We have a control order regime. But we don't have anything that applies to people who are in New Zealand but who have engaged in activities that might warrant placing some constraints on them. So we're looking at introducing that as well. And that might have made a difference in this. It might have placed them under more constraints. It might have meant that the police, rather than having to conduct covert state surveillance operation, might have conducted an operation on the basis that they were right next to him, escorting him wherever he went and whatever he did, or if not him, then corrections officers or whatever. But again, it's not clear whether, even if that a law like that was in place, that could have made a difference. I think we're going to have to get through the passing the law first and gauge whether or not it could have made a difference.
Well, when we talked about the security agency's review back in April, you said there isn't any evidence for more powers to be invested in the GCSB and SIS. Has this incident changed your decision?
No, I mean, we're certainly not looking at creating more powers for either of those agencies. They're quite intrusive powers. The SIS was fully engaged with the terrorist who carried out the attack on Friday. He's been a person of interest to them since 2016, and they have been doing their job in relation to him since all of that time. So it's not about a question of more powers for the intelligence agencies, but it might be that the courts and authorities such as the police or corrections could do with some more powers to deal with, the very extreme cases like this one, where somebody is very dangerous. And in order to keep the community safe, because they've exhausted any prison sentence, they have to go out into the community, that we have the means to keep tabs on them so that the rest of the community is kept safe. That's where we're trying to get to.
I might just go back onto the counter-terrorism legislation for a bit. The Greens particularly say they don't want the government to pass this under urgency because it would send a wrong message towards migrant communities, Maori and refugees. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I know because I started the work on these changes back in 2018. So we have taken, you know, our time to think very carefully and in a very considered way about the changes that we're making. We held off on making the changes pending the publication of the report of the Royal Commission into the Christchurch mosque attacks, because we know that that was an issue they were going to engage with as well, and we wanted to make sure there wasn't any point in making some changes at one point and then waiting for the Royal Commission's report and making some more changes, but we did do it all at once. The Royal Commission put quite considerable effort and time into their deliberations about what might need to change with our terrorism legislation. So bringing all of that work together led to us, you know, introducing legislation in the House at the beginning of the year. It's gone through the Select Committee process. There have been a fair few submissions on it. And so I think that no one can claim that we have rushed this. It has taken place in a very deliberate sort of way. So, and we do need a good debate. Parliament needs to have a good debate on it. And we will have time to do that. And I think you'll see over the next few weeks that we do that. But what is very clear is that we do need something in place sooner rather than later.
Some people have raised concerns that the terrorist continues to remain in New Zealand, even though his refugee status was revoked by Immigration New Zealand. Well, the government has been trying to deport him since 2017. And based on this, do you think the refugee process needs to be reformed to address these concerns?
He did have his refugee status revoked. He then exercised his right of appeal on that, which he was doing. And the law is that if he's in prison, then the tribunal that deals with those appeals can't consider it. He has to be out of prison and free. They therefore hadn't got around to it. I think there is a question about how we do, you know, the time it takes to conduct these appeals. I think the other question was that even if he had his appeal considered, there was a question about whether he, in international law, constitutes a protected person. That is to say, a person who, if he did have his refugee status permanently revoked and had to go back to his country of origin, Sri Lanka, would he be in danger? Because we're not allowed to put people in danger. That said, of course, he was a danger to people in New Zealand. So we do need to have a look at the law to make sure that we don't get ourselves in a trap where we take someone in as a refugee, but if we return them to the original country, they would be under threat, and therefore we can't remove them from the country, even though they constitute a serious threat here. We do need to have a look at the law around that.
Okay. Just a final touch on mental health during lockdown now. We are now in day 23 of level 4 in Auckland, and we were talking to several students and they were telling us their mental well-being is deteriorating. So what kind of support has the government given to mental health services in Auckland particularly?
Well, we've certainly given additional funding to organisations that do provide mental health support to young people. We've just put out a round of funding at the moment for a number of organisations, so we'll be making some decisions in the next few days on additional funding for organisations whose support services are pitched principally at young people, at young Māori, Rangatahi and young Pacific people. In addition to that, we had provided additional funding last year to university and polytech student health services for additional mental health support, so they should have that in place as well. So if young people, particularly students, are feeling particularly pressured and anxious or getting depressed, then they should be in contact with their student welfare services and student health services because they've got additional resources to help them through.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.